Call to order this meeting of the State and Local Government Operations and Oversight Committee, Monday, March 23rd, 2009. First item is the approval of the minutes.
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel?
I wasn't at the meeting because I was at the pension meeting. I do have a question here. On page 2, the first bill up to 1052, there's a sentence that says, Senator Robley moved an oral amendment, line 1.9, delete, quotation mark, close paren, CGIP, close paren, comma, either, and then there's a close paren. That looks odd.
Senator Betzel, that's an error.
What
should it be? The second close paren needs to be deleted. Gotcha. That correction will be shown on the minutes. Any other corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor of Senator Betzel's, well, no, he wasn't here.
I wasn't here.
Senator Carlson's motion to approve the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
As corrected. All those in favor, all those opposed say no. The motion prevails and the minutes stand approved as corrected. Senator Clark. Senator Clark brings us Senate File 1230. Would you fill that in? Senator Clark has an author's amendment. Senator Carlson moves the A3 amendment on behalf of Senator Clark. And then, and included in that amendment is to also delete Section 5. Senator Clark, all those in favor of Senator Carlson's motion to adopt the A3 amendment, including deleting Section 5, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. This amendment is adopted. Senator Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Today, you have in front of you a continuation of the work that we all have been doing together with the administration to focus on longer-range planning, figuring out how we better use the milestones and how to best utilize the limited resources that we have. The bill in front of you with the changes has within the office, within the Department of Administration, an Office of Strategic and Long-Range Planning. We used to have a separate entity that worked on this. We haven't in a bit, but we've got a lot of people throughout state government that have been trying to do some work on this. This would permit a little bit more focus at the Department of Administration. It also has in there a focus on long-range planning, which I think Mr. Gillespie would reinforce the importance of that. There is a report in there with regard to information that may be helpful to all of us about managing for the long term. Under the part of the state demographer, it talks about a demographic forecast in conjunction with the Commissioner of Finance and the November economic forecast. It also, and I'm going to have others talk a bit more about this, we have been working with the department, with the University of Minnesota, about how to actually better utilize some coordinated opportunities to really strengthen what we're doing in the area of the demographer and looking at, frankly, how we could actually have a similar arrangement to like we have with the state economist. And so we're not quite there with the language yet, but we have been working on that. And then with regard to milestones, it is focuses on building on the efforts that we passed last year to keep trying to find ways that we are utilizing the goals that we have, but doing a better job also with the indicators. And Madam Chair, I do have some very good people here that could talk a little bit more briefly. I know you have a full agenda about what we're trying to accomplish here.
Yeah. Senator Clark, what language do you think is not ready to be acted on?
It's ready. What on the amendment lines 1.4 to 1.6 talk about contracting for the development of data and research required under this chapter. which relates back to what we're trying to do with the University of Minnesota. But we believe that this has been kind of a work in progress, that we may be able to even strengthen the relationship more. And I believe that a couple, all three of the people sitting with me could talk more specifically to that, Madam Chair.
Okay, so the, one of the things you did with your author's amendment was to delete the independent agency language.
Yes.
And then on page three, expanding the language with regard to the state demographer and then adding a report. That's essentially what amendment did. Is that correct?
Yes, and Madam Chair, it aligns the milestones report just a bit better than what the previous language it wasn't.
What the introduced language did.
Yes.
Okay. Let's see. Did you want the commissioner? Or
yes, but
who would you like to have?
We start with the commissioner.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Madam Chair and Senators, I'm Dana Badgerow, the Commissioner of Administration. I have been working, along with the demographer Tom Gillespie, have been working with Senator Clark and others on resurrecting the milestones. We've been working on that project for, I guess, almost 2 years now. It did culminate in a legislatively required report, which we issued on March 6th, which took a look at the Minnesota milestone indicators and examined through a kind of collaborative process with a number of people how many of them are still current, how many, in fact, need to be revised or revitalized. And that report, which was essentially prepared by Mr. Gillespie here, indicates that some are, as you would expect, some are still quite valid, but there are many others that need to be updated and made more current. It also recommends that we explore extensively working with the Wilder Foundation, who has a COMPASS report that used to be limited to the metropolitan area but now is being expanded statewide. So there may be a tremendous synergy between what we're seeking to achieve with milestones and statewide measures with work that's being done, I'll call it, in the private sector, in the nonprofit sector. So having said all of that, I just want to underscore that I support Senator Clark's desire to have a long-range strategic plan for the state of Minnesota and whatever we can do to assist with that. And furthermore, I guess I should address the demographer and the we've been looking, of course, at, you know, what is the, to begin with, Mr. Gillespie here is eligible to retire. And that will be the loss of a great treasure.
Say it isn't so.
I mean, Madam Chair, we may have to have a bill to prohibit that from happening.
But regrettably, so is his staff. And we stand the risk of actually losing a great resource in the executive branch. If we allow that to happen, I think they're probably waiting till after the census, which is a big deal for the demographer's office. But we don't have a succession plan. And we felt that, and we've had discussions now with the University of Minnesota, that a greater synergy with the University of Minnesota's demographic center of expertise might be a good thing. And so we are actually talking about the prospect of merging the two. And I think I'll just leave it at that, since this current bill doesn't actually address that head on. But we are quite supportive of that notion.
Gillespie. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Tom Gillespie. I'm the Minnesota State Demographer in the Department of Administration, and I don't have immediate plans for retirement, at least not that I'm aware of. A closer cooperation with the University of Minnesota Population Center would allow us to begin to train young professionals into some of the dark mysteries of the things that we do in forecasting and population estimates that are not part of the regular training program in many universities. There really are not universities. There have been programs in the past in the nation, but there really are not programs that train people in the specifics of how to do forecasting or small area estimates. And one of the issues that we face, as well as many others, is the issue of not having trained people to replace us when we retire. It's a highly specialized field, and by having a closer relationship with the University of Minnesota, we would be able to do that. The issue of the milestones report has been raised, and there is a lot of work that needs to be done on the milestones indicators. We do have some options available to us, and I think we can go forward on that with a relatively modest commitment of resources to really reinvigorate that process and make it into a useful tool for budgeting and planning in the state. One other aspect is one of the recommendations that the Budget Trends Commission made this past January to the legislature was to have a regularly scheduled long-run forecast that is a joint forecast of the demographer and the state economist, and I certainly would underscore that as I think a very valid and reasonable thing to do.
Madam Chair, lastly, we have Steve Ruggles from the University of Minnesota.
Mr. Ruggles.
I'm Steve Ruggles, Regents Professor in Population Studies and Director of the Minnesota Population Center. And the Minnesota Population Center is the primary demographic research organization of the state in the sense of academic research. And we think, and President Brunix feels strongly, that there would be important synergies to having the state demographer's office merged with the Population Center. For one thing, there's no place else in the state where people care about life tables and projection techniques and all of those other good things. And so we think that the state demographer would the office would benefit by being immersed in an environment of people who care about demography. It would also offer a degree of independence, just as the state economist has had for the state demographer. And the university would benefit, as Tom mentioned. There are very few places in the country that train people in local population estimation and the other skills that are represented so well in the current office. And we would like to establish a program, and it would be a tremendous opportunity if our students were able to actually be involved in developing these kinds of estimates, and it would be wonderful training. So we're very excited about this possibility.
Thank you very much. Are there questions or comments for Senator Clark or her witnesses? Senator Olsen.
Madam Chair, Senator Clark, is there a fiscal note on this? Or?
Madam Chair and Senator Olsen, not anymore.
Senator Olsen, we took the appropriation out of it. We don't know if there's fiscal impact, but this bill is going to the Rules Committee anyway, and they can do with that as part of the reform package or whatever there.
Senator Olsen, one of the hopes would be is the budget improves that there may be able to be more of an allocation for the kind of longer range planning that we know is important, but also if we're able to do more connected work with the university and with Wilder, there really can be some resources brought to bear. So Commissioner Badgero's staff is a small but mighty and dynamic group of people, and one of the things we've talked about is trying to figure out how to better connect. There are people in each of the agencies that are looking longer term, but figuring out they could better work together on how to develop more of the long-range strategy for the state.
Commissioner?
Yes, Madam Chair and Senator Olsen, the fiscal impact is if we transfer the staff, which is 4.1 headcount, we would also transfer the dollars associated with them, which is $425,000 annually in the next biennium, as well as the $250,000 that was appropriated for specific support of the census. So that money would actually be removed from our department budget and from Senator Betzel's committee's jurisdiction and moved to the university as part of this transfer. With respect to the how do we get the milestones done, that is a challenge, I have to say. And the report that we prepared and was submitted on March 6 indicates it would take about two FTEs to get us up and running and get the website back up and revitalized, and probably one FTE on an ongoing basis to keep it going. What we're really hoping is that some of those resources will be available to us as we merge with the university. And we're also hoping, of course, as Senator Clark indicated, to energize the people in each agency who are, in fact, today doing strategic and long-range planning for their agency or their function or their process. If we could figure out a way to bring them together, we have a strategic planning committee for the state of Minnesota. It's just fragmented and in silos today.
Senator Rolstein?
A follow-up, Madam Chair. Senator Clark, I served on a boundary adjustment task force, and would this go as far as to look at long-range planning between cities and townships? We've heard a number of bills this session about, you know, long-range planning and that kind of growth. Would this go that far, or was this more looking at population?
Madam
Chair.
Senator
Clark.
And Senator Olson, this would be about state long-term planning. That doesn't, one shouldn't probably preclude the opportunities if others want to participate in the longer-term vision, but this really is about the state. One of the great things, if the milestones can really be utilized, though, is there'd be great information that could be used for cities and counties, and they could make better decisions. Because part of, you may recall, with what Governor Carlson set out to do originally and what some other states, we were ahead of the curve. We were ahead of the nation originally. We're kind of behind now, so we're trying to move us back to a place where it can be ahead of the curve. But part of the thought really is, when you think about these broader goals, it isn't just about state government or local governments. It's also about businesses and citizens. So the information that could be brought to bear could help with all levels of planning, but the actual long-range planning would really be what is done by the state.
Further questions or comments? Senator Betzel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Clark, page 2, line 1 and 2, the director must submit a report to the governor and the legislature no later than the first week in December of each year. Now, of course, especially in election year, you may have one or both of the legislative bodies might even be organized. So if there's a report coming in, you know, who do you send it to? It, you know, in December, if it coming into December of each year, and plus, even if it's here when the legislature is going to be here in January, why should it be here in December when it's going to sit around for a month and nobody's going to see it?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair and Senator Betzel, I mean, we could certainly change the date if you want. The thought was to try to do it to coincide with the forecast so that there be some similar information coming out roughly at the same time. If it could come out if it's actually in November. Would be done in November, but if it's done like this year in the first week of December, it would be done then so that you'd have a simultaneous, you'd have broader information at the same time.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Betzel,
the governor's office probably could use it. Again, if you send it to the legislature, particularly in November of an election year, I don't know who's going to use it in the legislative branch.
Sure. Do you have a suggestion, Senator Betzel, of what you'd like, what would make more sense from a legislative standpoint? I mean, I think we would like it to the information to get out around the forecast, but in terms of the actual legislature, another date is certainly fine.
You can't have two different dates.
Well,
we've usually used January 15th.
Sure. So, Madam Chair,
Madam Chair, I would move on page 2, line 2, to strike no later than the first week in December of each year and insert by January 15 of each year.
Madam Chair.
Senator, we've heard Senator Betzel's motion to amend. Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Clark, there's nothing to prevent them from submitting the report earlier.
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, what Mr. Gillespie just told me is they would still be able, obviously under that language, to do something with regard to the forecast, but then do the report to the legislature at that time. So probably give them some flexibility in terms of how they're actually presented. And as long as they're willing to do it around the forecast, that I think that solves the other need.
Sure. Okay, we have Senator Betzel's motion. All those in favor of the motion to amend on page 2, line
2.
2. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Is there further discussion on Senate File 1230? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to speak either in favor or in opposition to Senate File 1230? Seeing none, Senator Olsen moves that Senate File 1230, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Rules. All who may be in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Clark. Senator Tomassoni, is he in the room? Senator Bonoff is in the room.
Despite the fact that we have two
Senator Bonhoff brings us Senate File 1459. Senator Bonhoff. This is the state cooperative purchasing contract used by local governments requirement.
Yes, Madam Chair, and I believe there should be an amendment at the desk.
Yep, it's here. A1.
And if I could get a copy of that as well, please.
Thank you. Senator Carlson, on behalf of Senator Bonhoff, moves the this is the first committee, correct?
Yes,
moves the A1 amendment. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This is a bill that is similar in nature to the bill I have brought here previously with regard to school districts. This bill states that for fiscals year 2010, 2011, and 2012, and I will acknowledge Senator Roebling for that amendment because I thought it was a good suggestion on the other bill, and so we did put it on this bill as well, that for those years, whenever practicable and cost-effective, Minnesota cities, counties, and townships must contract for the purchase of supplies, materials, or equipment by utilizing contracts that are available through the state's cooperative purchasing venture. And really what we're doing here with this bill is we are saying that we ought to use this time of economic hardship to make the kind of changes that perhaps we should have made a long time ago. But certainly during these times, we should be doing everything that we can to make sure our dollars go as far as possible and we are being most efficient as possible. And the more I've gotten to know the work of the Department of Administration, the more I think that we ought to be encouraging everybody, you know, cities, counties, school districts, to be utilizing their services. There's really no reason why not. But again, while this does say that cities and counties and townships purchase first from the state, it does say whenever cost-effective and practical. So that, in fact, it is a pretty loose mandate.
Senator Bonhoff, who would determine whether a contract or this purchasing requirement is practicable and cost effective? Would it be the local government? And don't you think you ought to specify that or not?
Madam Chair, I'd like to defer at this point to Mr. Allen.
Madam Chair, before you do that, didn't the A1 amendment delete that phrase, though?
Well, it inserted it in a different place. If you look at the two, it's like those years, whenever practical and cost-effective, and then deleted it in line 10.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, and that was really at the request of the League of Cities who came to see me this morning. They said that that their cities and counties were somewhat concerned about a mandate, and they saw that that was in there, and so that made their concern a little less present, but if it was put first, that would help them feel even better about it. So while I didn't really think it was material, if that helped, that was fine. Mr. Allen,
who would make the determination whether something is practicable or cost effective?
Madam Chair, that determination would be made by the local unit of government. That was always our intention. So if it helped to state that more explicitly, that would presumably be fine. The Department of Administration doesn't have the staff or inclination to audit or police this. We really want to work with local units that are seeing the benefit. And if they don't see the benefit of the contracts that we would develop, we would want them to have the option to use appropriate alternatives.
But then does it harm the bill, Senator Bonhoff, if language after your line 1-3, that cost-effective was added there as determined by the affected local government?
Madam Chair, Commissioner, do you have any questions? Madam Chair, that's fine with me.
Also move, Madam Chair.
Will you move that?
I'll move that, and I think it's a good amendment. For instance, Senator Kubley and I know other legislators from greater Minnesota have commented that it might be more expensive sometimes, but they do have a desire to sometimes deal with their local merchants and help them out where they can, too. So I think that they would, you know, I think we need to give them the opportunity to make that. So I think determined by the local unit of government or how you phrase it would be a good amendment. So that's all. Hey,
Mr. Bodern or Mr. McGowan?
Madam Chair, I have some language here. Amending the A1 amendment would be what it would be after whenever insert determined to be, and then after cost-effective insert by the city, county, or township.
Okay.
So it would read, for fiscal years 2010, 2011, and 2012, whenever determined to be practicable and cost-effective by the city, county, or township.
And we would, I mean, I do think it's a challengeable determination, so they can't just willy-nilly say this is not cost-effective or this is not practicable, because they could be called and held accountable for making that determination. And if it was seen to be, you know, injudiciously applied, then I think their constituents would have a reason to come and complain.
Very good.
So we've heard Senator Betzel's motion. Is there further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of the Betzel motion to amend, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Commissioner, did you want to testify?
Yes, Madam Chair and Senators. I'll start it off, but I think Mr. Allen has the substantive testimony. I simply want to say that we know from the Department of Revenue records that cities, counties, and townships spend over $2 billion on goods and services, and those are the ones that are taxable. And we know that there's a good number of those purchases that are non-taxable. So the spend, as we call it in the sourcing world, is extensive. And so we just know that we've been able to achieve significant savings on our state contracts on only $1 billion worth of spend. We know that many cities, counties, not many townships, but a few are currently using state contracts, but we know that many are not. And we simply want to broaden the opportunity for, we all need money. Everyone needs to save money. We have tangible evidence that state agencies are saving money under these contracts, and we would like for that same opportunity to be available to our other citizens, other local units. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Allen to give some
Mr. Allen,
testimony.
Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Kent Allen. I'm the Director of the Materials Management Division of the Department of Administration. We do feel there's an opportunity here for the Department of Administration to better assist and serve local units of government. I think most of you know we have a cooperative purchasing program now that in many cases allows cities and counties and townships to purchase off state contracts. But we haven't taken the opportunity to directly assess the needs of cities, counties, and townships that were not meeting with state contracts. And if this bill passed, we would do that in a proactive way, identifying needs that would otherwise be unmet. We're having real success in enterprise strategic sourcing across state agencies. As you know, we have the authority to develop contracts that state agencies are required to use. And we make 882 of those available to cities and counties now. Those are the ones that where the vendors have agreed they're willing to make the same pricing available to local units of government. One of the interesting facts about the contracts that we have in place now is that roughly 70% of those are with Minnesota businesses. But with the exception of school buses, none of those contracts were really developed specifically to meet the needs of local units of government. So if this bill were to pass, we would be working with the local units, identifying the areas where their needs aren't met. We're assuming that some of the types of contracts that would be relevant would be water and waste processing equipment, firefighting equipment, gravel, some of the sorts of things that state agencies don't buy for themselves, but that local units of government buy based on the functions of local government. Again, as Dana and Senator Bonhoff said here, clearly the intent is not to impose contracts on an unwilling customer base. We really want to be working with the local units, seeing how we can be helpful, developing contracts. And really, I think all we're asking in return is that they would look at those contracts before using another purchasing option. We can point out numerous instances where we're saving state agencies really dramatic amounts of money. Examples include our recent contracts for what are called multifunction devices. That's the new name for the big computer slash copier slash printer slash scanner that does just about anything a large office machine could do for you. In one case, we have a 68% savings through our current contract off the previous contract price. Primary reason is because we're developing standards, working with state agencies, agreeing as customers that we will buy a more limited number of makes and models in order to bring the price down on those makes and models. Cities and counties and townships really benefit from that because they're not required to use those same standards that state agencies are, but to the extent they choose to use those standards, they get a much reduced price by going with that make and model. Just a couple of quick examples of the sorts of savings we're seeing there because they're pretty dramatic. On our multifunction machines, here's a real-life example from the Materials Management Division. We currently have 7 multifunction machines and 1 printer that involve the current state contracts. With the new standards-based state contracts, we're going to be able to replace all of those machines, trade in the printer for an extra multifunction machine. We have to buy out 3 contracts that haven't expired yet. But even doing that, we still will save $44,000 over the first 3 years that we're using the new contracts. That's 8 machines and 1 relatively small part of state government. Another example where we think the standards have led to just dramatic savings is desktop computer equipment. Just 2 examples as a representation here. If you're using the WSCA contracts, which are developed for multiple, the use of multiple states, most of the 50 states use these to some degree, and bought a mid-level desktop computer for your employees, you'd be paying $1,039. If you agree that you can make the Minnesota standard model work to meet your business needs, you'll be paying $563. A very, very dramatic reduction in cost to the degree to which those standards work for you. So the savings are there, but we really haven't taken the full opportunity to try to serve the needs of local units where we think we can find some comparable savings for them. Again, I think your amendment that makes it clear that it's ultimately a local decision as to whether this is their best value is entirely appropriate because that was our intention. We don't want to drag people kicking and screaming to contracts they're not interested in using, but we think if they look at them, they really will see that it's advantageous to take advantage of what the state can do.
Are there questions or comments for Senator Clark, Mr. Allen, or the Commissioner, Senator Olsen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Vonoff, I think you could get almost 100% participation if you offered a sales tax incentive, say 3% sales tax instead of 6%.
Madam Chair, Senator Olsen, thank you for that advice.
I don't think Senator Bach would go for it.
Yeah, don't take it. Because it violates a streamlined sales tax agreement, so we do not want to go there.
Well, Madam Chair, Chicago County buys a $160,000 snowplow. They're paying $10,000 in sales tax.
And I can tell you that if we didn't already impose that in times of economic collapse, as in the time when it was imposed, we would probably be looking at that again, however so reluctantly. Any other questions or comments for Senator Bonoff? Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Bonoff, what is your bill doing that local units of government can't do now under current law?
Madam Chair, Senator Sieben, local units of government can do that, and right now, one-third of cities and townships, counties, well, counties is a different story. Almost all the counties take advantage, but one-third of the cities and townships takes advantage. That means two-thirds are not, and so that's what they can do now. I'm hoping with this legislation, because while they do have an option, because we've got this whenever practicable and cost-effective, the fact that we are directing them to at least look in this manner, I'm hoping we'll pick up a significant amount of the two-thirds that are not currently doing this.
Any further questions or comments, Mr. Allen?
Could I just add, Madam Chair and Senator Sieben, the big change is that our department would add a couple staff to try to work directly with local units, and those people aren't on our staff now and wouldn't be unless we get this authorization to work more closely with local units and require local units to use the contracts if they're practicable and cost-effective.
Madam Chair?
I knew we were coming to you, Senator Day.
No, I just woke up when somebody said you're going to hire staff to do this.
Madam Chair, Senator Day, we are. And the program is paid for by the fees that are paid by contracted vendors. So there's no cost to the general fund. The program is self-supporting. We have authority under existing law to raise sufficient funds to cover the administrative costs of the program. We're not allowed to make money, but we're allowed to raise sufficient funds to cover those costs.
Madam Chair, let me get this right.
Senator Day.
Cities now can do exactly what Senator Bonhoff is telling us they can do if they want to do it. And even if you hire the people and tell them this great deal, they don't have to do it. That's a pretty tricky program.
Madam Chair, if I might.
How does that work? I don't quite get that.
Commissioner Badgerow?
We would not hire the people unless the volume was there. I mean, we would have to be collecting the fees. As the volume increases, we will get the fees anyway because the volume is they're volume-based fees. So you get an incremental dollar of volume under this contract, we're going to get another tiny bit of fee. So that money is there. It will come as more people use the contract. So it's a little bit of chicken and egg. We want to dedicate those people specifically to the needs of local governments, which we're not currently addressing. So these are, in effect, at a no additional general fund cost, no additional cost to the local units. We will have dedicated staff that will work with those local units on their specific needs.
Madam Chair,
Senator Day.
I feel really terrible you aren't already doing this. I mean, you have all these programs, and the cities and counties are sitting out there. And so then, and they maybe can save some money. You have 800 programs, and they don't know about it unless now we hire a couple people, and the vendors pay for the program, and we do all this. And even at that, the city council can just go to Walmart and buy it anyway. I don't know.
Madam Chair.
It's kind of confusing to
Senator
me.
Senator Bonhoff.
Madam Chair, Senator Day, I knew when that statement was made that it was the opening that you might take. And so I can appreciate those comments, especially when we're having, you know, hiring freeze, wage freeze. And so I think that we all are cognizant of the need to not increase staff. I think that when we look at the large purchases of fire equipment, some of the other, you know, snow plows, some of the large things that if we could take advantage of bulk purchasing, the kinds of savings that when we add that up over time, that would be worth spending a small amount to save a lot. And I think that you always have to keep that formula in mind when you evaluate policy.
Madam Chair and Senator Bonhoff, I was just trying to help you out a little bit because I didn't want another bill to get to the floor, and you know, it'll be on the floor for a while, and we wait for enough people to vote for it and whatever. Cause this is an awful lot like the school bill that we didn't pass the other day. I mean, very close, only it's just a different group of people. So it
Madam Chair and Senator Day, it's my hope that I'll bring that bill back up, and this time we'll have those votes.
I'm sure you will, but
okay. Is there further discussion on Senate file 1459? Seeing none, Senator Rolstein moves that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rolstein, we have a long agenda.
No, no, I may be voting against this, so I don't.
Okay. Senator Betzel moves Senate file 1459 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the committee. Oh, is there anybody else, I'm sorry, that was just to speak, I'm sorry, on the bill? I forgot that. Then we'll come back to a motion. Ask you to be brief.
Absolutely, Madam Chair.
And not repetitive.
My name is Jennifer O'Rourke with the League of Minnesota Cities, and Patty Nauman wanted to be here as well with the Metro Cities Organization, but I can definitely speak for the two of us, and I will be brief. First of all, I'd like to thank Senator Bonoff for being so accommodating this morning, both with our concerns in the amendment that came before you and just having the time to actually visit before the bill was up. But frankly, it is very fair to say that our preference would be no bill and not having this become statute, because right now cities can already take part of this in this program with the state. I would tell you that...
Ms. O'Rourke, why don't they?
Why don't they?
If it's so great... why don't they?
Well, we have 290 cities, by my count, that participate in the list that the state brought forward. And there's a lot of creative things going on at the local level. We already have joint powers sort of ventures where the city pairs up with the county or the school district to buy office supplies and such. We have cities that, frankly, want to support their local downtown vendors or and probably even the Walmart that Senator Day talked about and keep their dollars locally. I know that we have cities that are partners with
so
the state's program.
So their budgets are supported by LGA that the rest of us pay for. You want to explain that one?
Could you repeat your question, please?
I said, so their budgets are supported by LGA to make those choices that all the rest of us pay for.
That's a good point, Madam Chair. You know, frankly, in our discussions back at the League, we wish that number was higher as well. We've certainly got publications, various publications that we've advertised this in before. We've had the department come to some of our different conferences and such, and I'd like to think that we do work with them as a business partner in promoting this program. I didn't have time to go out and talk to 600 cities, some of which get LGA and some of which don't, and ask them about their dealings with the program. So,
okay, Mr. Simmons.
Scott Simmons, the Association of Minnesota Counties. Let me just piggyback on that a little bit. I think the committee should understand that the program that's sponsored by and run by the state agency is not the only game in town. Counties, cities, local governments have been participating in U.S. communities for almost two decades now. It's a cooperative purchasing program that is actually belonged to by almost 1,000 registered local government agencies in Minnesota. We purchase about $24 million a year through the U.S. Communities Program. One of the differences is that it's a nonprofit. It's not a government agency. It's run by a nonprofit, the board of which is comprised of purchasing agents from about 20 city, county, school district throughout the United States. It's a national purchasing cooperative. There's other purchasing cooperatives. In addition to admins contracts, there's the Western State Contracting Alliance. There's the National Joint Powers Association. I guess briefly, Madam Chair, our concern with the bill is that it sort of pits one purchasing cooperative against another existing effective purchasing cooperative that we've lived with now for almost two decades. To suggest that counties, and I should say counties are participating, all but three counties already participate in the state's program. There's 97 county entities that participate in the U.S. Communities program. So we're already playing, we're stepping up, looking for cost savings, efficiencies. But when one purchasing cooperative is pitted up against another, we don't think that's fair. To prioritize in law that local governments actually have to choose one before they can go to another that they have experience with is sort of picking legislative winners and losers. And I would represent that's probably not the best level playing field in town. And it doesn't speak to whether or not the local governments can actually use the Main Street businesses. I'm not convinced personally with language, having just seen it today, that allows the local governments to decide what's practicable, because it's practicability and cost-effective. And it's the conjunction is and, not or. And there's other issues besides cost that are important to local governments, in terms of delivery, customer service. What is the best value proposition for local governments is not always judged by mere price alone. So we're not comfortable with the bill, even having about, you know, 84 counties and 97 county entities participate already in national purchasing cooperatives. We're not comfortable with the mandate. And that's my testimony, Madam Chair.
Okay, Madam Senator Bonoff, you have any response?
Yep, Madam Chair, Mr. Simmons, for the record, you know, I have been impressed with the amount of counties that do participate in state contracts, and so I suspect there will not be near as much change, even potentially, with the counties, because it seems like the counties are doing a wonderful job. So I would have hoped that the counties would then have supported this effort so that we could get more of the cities and townships. But I have been surprised, given this is the...
would have reduced their price, too.
Yes, exactly. Given that this is the second such bill I've carried, during these times when we know that we're either going to be making major cuts or, you know, people are talking about, do we have to raise revenue, the couple bills where we are saying we've got to do things differently, we have to, you know, use this as an occasion to reform our business practices, I've been surprised at the amount of just strong resistance to making those kind of changes. And so I would urge the members that we, you know, take a leadership role and say, you know, that's why there's only 3 years here, 2010, 2011, 2012. Let's try it. If it doesn't work, the cities, counties, townships don't see savings, don't experience a better way, then they won't do it after that. But it's my suspicion and that not only will we save money, that they will come to view this as an asset. And that is, again, why we put the 3 years in. And so I ask the legislators to make the tough choices and lead in this way.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Bonoff. Senator Vickerman.
Madam Chair, coming from the southern part of the state, I have three cities or states close to me. I used to be a county commissioner.
Thank you.
I'm trying to keep my towns alive. I'm doing the very best I can. And, you know, it bothers me when all at once we'll have them do that. What's wrong with it? I know county commissioners make their own decisions. Nobody else has to make that decision for us. So, Senator Bonoff, I'm not going to be able to support your bill for a simple reason. I think it takes something away from rural Minnesota, and we're struggling and struggling. The stores are going down, and I can't take anything away from them.
Madam Chair.
Senator Carlson.
Madam Chair and Senator Bonoff, do you have some examples of some savings that have been that could be realized, like some pricing of some certain commodities?
Commissioner, could you?
Thank you, Ms. O'Rourke and Mr. Simmons.
Isn't he here? Isn't he here? I'm going to ask Mr. Allen to make
their comments when I vote on how much to cut.
Madam Chair and Senator Carlson, I talked a little bit about some of the comparisons between the Minnesota contract price for our computer standards and the contract price for the WISCA program. The WISCA program, and Mr. Simmons mentioned U.S. communities. I've also got the data on the U.S. communities pricing. Again, going back to a desktop computer, WISCA $1,039, U.S. communities $1,072, state of Minnesota standards $563. A unit developed for K-12 educational desktop. And here, the U.S. Communities has a better price than the WISCA price. $837 for WISCA, $776 for U.S. Communities. But if the K-12 institution agrees that it can make the standards desktop work to meet their needs, it's only $447. So some very dramatic savings in some of these cases. When we went to cell phone contracts, agencies reported up to 60% savings off. When we standardized, agencies reported up to 60% savings off what they were paying previously. I also mentioned the example of the multifunction devices in our own agency. We're going to save $44,000 in a relatively small part of state government over 3 years, even though we have to buy out our existing contracts because the new pricing is so good.
And Madam Chair. And
Senator Carlson.
Mr. Allen. So each of those specifics that you mentioned, they're a different spec. When you they're not really comparisons. They're not comparables. They might be comparables if you could get one or the other to change the spec.
Madam Chair, Senator Carlson, I don't understand your question. I concede I
Senator Carlson
not tracking with you.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Mr. Allen, you mentioned that the computer, if the school could agree to a certain different computer, I believe it was, you could go down to $400 and some. But the one that they had specified was, I think, was something like $600 and some. So it required a change of a spec, a change of a specification of the component purchased.
Madam Chair, Senator Carlson, to get that deep discount that's tied to the standards, yes, they would have to agree that a particular, and it's not one manufacturer, but it's sort of a standardized configuration that would be available from multiple manufacturers would get them that greatly reduced price. But if they had very unique needs that weren't met by that standard configuration, whether they used the state contract or the U.S. communities contract or something else, they would be paying those higher amounts.
And Madam Chair and Mr. Allen,
Carlson,
are those specifications available today for review by the different counties, school districts, whomever is now buying these multifunction machines? So they have seen those prices, seen that particular specification, and they've not accepted it. They've decided to go on their own. Is that a fair assumption?
Madam Chair, Senator Carlson, all of this information is public information. Some of it is quite readily available on various websites, and some is a little harder to get at, but it's all available to a local unit or a school that would want to do the price comparisons.
And, Madam Chair, just with regard to Senator Carlson's question, I know I often ask when we look at computers, does that allow for both a Apple-based or a PC-based? And the answer is yes. They do several manufacturers across platforms.
Any further questions? Senator Betzel, are you willing to move the bill?
Yes.
Senator Betzel moves that Senate file 1459 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Rules. All who are in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Bonoff. The next bill is Senator Tomassoni.
Declare it passed.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 79 pertains to the Central Iron Range Sanitary Sewer District. And, Madam Chair, I think for purposes of the committee, the only reason I'm here is because number one, Senator Betzel doesn't like amendments, and so I decided I should go the bill route. And the second reason is because we had a little technicality occur at the beginning of this calendar year. One of the townships that had to file a resolution with the Secretary of State got it in late, and so the sanitary sewer district basically inadvertently expired. And so in order to re-up it, we had to resubmit legislation. And so this has actually been around since 2002, and the various towns and townships that are involved with this are in the process of coming to an agreement on exactly how they're going to do it. I do expect to have an amendment later on that will reflect the agreement that the towns have come up with as to the memberships of the district, et cetera. But today, all I'm trying to do is get past committee deadlines so that it's alive and well when the time comes.
To explain it to you better,
Madam Chair, the district's been around for a while, and mm-hmm. the giving Chisholm, Buell, Great Scott, and Balkan townships have been meeting and trying to decide exactly how to do the district. And there's been some disagreement as to the formation of the board and whether or not they should go ahead with the original plan that was originally presented by the people who were on the board, or whether or not they should do a different plan and change the board makeup. And so as of right now, we have a resolution from Hibbing how they would like to see it done. Chisholm and Buell are in the process of coming up with their recommendation. It's possible we may change some things.
Senator Tomasoni, though, this bill's going to the floor. Is it? Is there action being taken in the other body?
Not yet. No. It's in the same committee in the other body. If I have an amendment on the floor, Madam Chair, it'll be an amendment that everybody has agreed to, so it won't be a controversial amendment. If you would feel better, Madam Chair, you can send it to my committee, and I can keep it off.
That would not necessarily make me feel better.
But, Madam Chair.
I've seen what happens in your committee. Senator
Madam
Pappas?
Chair, I just want to applaud Senator Tomasoni of not bringing an 18-page amendment to the floor, but actually bringing it to a committee.
Well, that may happen yet, but it'll be in reference to this.
Senator Roebling?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Tomasoni, I have to admit, as I read through this, I was a little confused about the sequence of events that occurred. And so is there currently a district, or it never got formed because somebody missed the deadline? Or they moved forward with it or not?
It expired. I know it's hard to believe this, but it expired on January 6th of this year because the letter that Balkan Township sent in didn't get to the Secretary of State on time. And so on that date, it expired. And so this is just reestablishing it so that it can be a legal district again. And
they're proposing to make some changes in it.
If
that letter from Balkan Township had gotten in on time, would we be looking at this legislation like this?
Madam Chair, we would probably not be looking at this legislation.
We'd be looking at something else, but not this.
Yes. Yeah.
Something that reflected the whatever new agreement.
Exactly.
Okay. Is there further discussion on Senate File 79? Seeing none, Senator Day, did you move this bill?
Oh, no. I'm happy.
Okay. Senator Day moves that Senate File 79 be recommended to pass, and it goes to the floor. All those in favor, is there anyone who wishes to speak either in favor or in opposition of this bill? We don't have anybody signed up. Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Not only did Senator Tomasoni get it introduced as a bill, but it's number 79, which means he got it introduced early, which is commendable.
And he even has a co-author. That's got to be a first, Senator Tomasoni.
Well, I'm just hoping that Senator Betzel realizes I'm really coming around here, so when he does start seeing some amendments, he doesn't get too upset.
All in favor of the day motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion
prevails.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair and committee members.
Okie dokie.
You typically just come to the full amendments all the time.
I know.
Somebody going to run the committee?
Get over there.
I'm under arrest. If you have a preference, you've got a couple of bills. 278.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to explain something about them, and I hope I don't get it confused. Both of these bills have to do with when vacancies occur. One of them has to deal with changing the way in which we fill a vacancy when a member of the United States Senate dies or resigns. And it is that bill that is going to be the one going forward. The other bill is going to be added to that bill as an amendment, and it is the bill that has the that deals with the vacancy in a nomination. That is when a candidate, regardless of for what office, either dies or suffers a catastrophic illness before the election takes place. It provides for instead of having a process to replace that candidate, that the party is just asked to name another candidate and they would be elected at a special election that takes place a month later. And the things to keep in mind for the first bill are, and I guess we could adopt a subcommittee report on that bill.
Yes, so we're talking about Senate File 278.
Yes.
We will adopt the Senator Rust moves to adopt the subcommittee.
Senator Sieben.
Senator Sieben moves to adopt the subcommittee report on Senate File 278. All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the motivation for the one of the replacing the Senate, sitting senator who resigns, I thought about that a lot when particularly with regard to this last election, when in a number of states, not just the most notorious instance, Illinois, but also Delaware, other states where Senator Obama, President-elect Obama, was asking members of the U.S. Senate to join his cabinet, New York for Senator Clinton, that there was a better way of approaching replacement, and that was to have a special election if there was more than 2 years remaining on those terms. And it is the case that every other office, statewide office, members of the Congress, and members of the legislature, when they have a vacancy when they're in office, they're all replaced through a special election. The only office that's not is that of the U.S. Senate. So it seemed to me that we should come into conformity with a number of other states to allow for a special election following the resignation, generally would be a resignation or the death of a senator. The other bill is an initiative from the from the Secretary of State's office and deals with what happens if, and mostly probably would be somebody dies while they are a candidate for a statewide office, what should be the process to electing that person. And so it seemed to me that it would be appropriate to put those two bills together. In addition, in the other body, the vacancy of a nomination bill was put on the early voting bill. And it seems to me that it's more appropriate if you're going to put two bills together that they deal with vacancies either in office or in one instance only, U.S. Senate, and or a vacancy in the actual a vacancy by a candidate's not being able to be on the ballot. So so I need to have, I'm going to move to amend Senate file. I want to have Senate file.
It appears, Senator Rust, we have an A1 amendment.
Yeah, 278. And the language of the amendment is the A1 amendment. So I have explained what it was. In the subcommittee, the language, and I'll ask Ms. Fraser to come forward on behalf of the Secretary of State's office, but the language of the nomination for or vacancy in a nomination, which simply means somebody that's on the ballot but is not necessarily elected, would be was not controversial. And the instance, I think, to recall, or there are two instances to recall. One is the death of Senator Wellstone.
He was both a candidate and a seated senator. Under the bills in front of you, there would be an election. If they were together, there would be an election. They're not the same, but there would be an election 1 month, essentially, after the November election to allow the parties to put their candidates' names forward. And it would be a decision of the party, and it would not be subject to a primary. So people would not file for office. They would simply be chosen by their party, much in the way that Senator Mondale would be or was. But that election would take place a month later, at which time it would not only be an election to replace a candidate, but it would also serve as an election to replace a sitting office holder. So unlike the instance where once that election was held and Senator Coleman prevailed, it would have been to the advantage of the state to have had Senator Coleman take office immediately so that he could have had the additional seniority. But Governor Ventura chose to replace the vacancy as a gubernatorial appointment with candidate and then Senator Barkley, who then served until the 1st of January or so. I think most people had assumed that whoever won that election would have been the appointee by the governor, but that was not to be the case. Under this bill, if the general election is also serving as a special election, the person that wins that election would be, whether it's, think of only but the death of a sitting senator, that then a special election is called. That's at the time of the general election, which often happens. It happened with the election of Senator Phoebe and Senator Kielash. Those were special elections, but they were held at the general election. They did not have to wait. Keep in mind, they did not have to wait until the next January to take office. They were sworn in within a few days. The same thing would happen in this instance then with the U.S. senator, and they would automatically become the senator. Right now, when we think of the legislative seats, the governor does not have the authority to appoint to have appointed someone to take the seat of Senator Wergen or Senator Larson in the time in between the November election and the January coming into the new session. And this would form a parallel process for a U.S. senator. The Secretary of State's bill deals with vacancies in the nomination, forgetting at this point that, or setting aside the notion that Senator Wellstone was a sitting senator, but everything else being the same, that election would be set aside, and there would be a single election among candidates chosen by their parties, or that particular one chosen by his party, or her party, and then an election occurring. And what does that avoid? That avoids people that cast absentee ballots for a candidate who has died, whose ballots legitimately cast are not going to be counted because they're not going to be able to get another absentee ballot, or they're not going to be, they're going to be unavailable to participate in the voting, and it is, although the provisions do call for anybody that had requested an absentee ballot that they would automatically be mailed another one for this special election without having to without having to submit a separate application. But it would avoid the kind of confusion and I would submit some chaos in the election that took place so quickly following Senator Wellstone's death, and instead would be inserted an orderly process by which to elect whoever that candidate would be. And Ms. Fraser can add to it if she likes, and I think there is a technical amendment that's...
Well, first, Senator Rust moves the A1 amendment. We'll continue discussion on the A1 amendment. And yes. We have a technical
changes to that.
Correction, Mr. Botter.
Mr. Chairman and members, if you look at on the A1 amendment on page 5, there are a couple minor additions in section 10 that should be made to reflect how the absentee balloting process works. On page 5, line 13, after 203B.04, insert or 203B.17. And then on lines, page 5, lines 14 and 16, delete mail and insert transmit.
And that takes care of sending the absentee ballots overseas to our military voters. They're not mailed.
Senator Rust incorporates that into her A1 amendment. And my understanding is that this is essentially the 745 as was amended by the subcommittee.
Yes, the proposals are identical.
Amendments. So,
other than what we just made, that technical amendment.
Right. Ms. Fraser, did you have additional comments regarding the A1 amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, quickly. Beth Fraser with the Office of the Secretary of State. The primary reason for moving in this direction and the big difference between now and 2002 is the passage of the Federal Help America Vote Act and the state's adoption of similar requirements for state elections, that accessible voting equipment be used in almost all elections with very limited exceptions. And it's not really possible after the primary to reprogram all of the equipment in the way that would be necessary to provide accessible voting equipment in the case of the death of a candidate. And so in order to comply with federal and other state laws, we really need to have a special election. And so this sets that up.
Thank you, Ms. Fraser. Senator Betzold.
Mr. Chair, and just to clarify, because I'm not on the subcommittee, Senator Rust, you were giving some examples, you know, of legislative elections, and you're also talking about assuming office immediately upon a special election. Was what you're referring to, and in this bill's applying to statewide officers or legislative officers or every one of them?
Senator Rust.
So I understand it, when someone is elected in a special election, that if they're members of Congress or the legislature, if it's a special election, then once their election is certified, they may be sworn in. But since a vacancy in the U.S. Senate, let's say someone resigned January 1st and still had 2 years to go on their term. Right now, the governor would just appoint that person. And what happened with the election with Senator Wellstone is he was both a candidate and a seated senator. And so that special election, there was a vacancy in the office, as well as a vacancy of the candidacy, so that the person who was elected in November of 2002 was being elected to take office in January. Meanwhile, there was a vacancy in the office, and the only way that we could have that second senator was for the governor to appoint a person, because that office was then vacant because of Senator Wellstone's death. And it could have been the case that Governor Ventura, prior to the November election, since there had been a vacancy, could have appointed anyone he wanted from the third week in October until the end of December to be the second U.S. senator. And what that bill is suggesting is that instead of that, that the person who wins that election, the general election, which is in turn a special election, would be automatically declared the senator and be sworn in.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, obviously we have some unique ways of filling the office of U.S. Senator. I was a bit confused as to references to the legislative seats because, you know, clearly if there's a vacancy in a legislative seat and there's some time left to be served, the governor would call for a special election, and who's ever elected will fill in from the time the vacancy occurs,
right,
which may or may not be at the time of the election. For example, I remember years ago Senator Betty Adkins resigned in her term, but effective the following January 1st.
Right.
And so, but since she has submitted a resignation, Governor Carlson scheduled a special election. Senator Arado was elected in November but couldn't assume office until the resignation occurred, which was 2 months later.
Mr. Chairman, and part of the complications of those situations are that you don't have to call a special election unless the legislature is in session. And if they are in session, then the results of the special election for the legislator are declared, and that person is sworn in right then. But if we're not in session, which would have been the case also, not only with the effective date of Senator Adkins' resignation, which was also the case for Senator Larson, quite frankly, then they would not be sworn in until January. However, the election of Senator Bonoff, on the other hand, once she was declared the winner, she was sworn in, even though we were not in session.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator, there was a vacancy there.
Right.
But the other concern I've got, though, is that sometimes, when the legislature is adjourned sine die and one body or both bodies are up for election, sometimes their members, for whatever, just resign before their term has expired. Somebody is elected in November, to take over office. Now, would they be taking over immediately, or would they be taking over when the next term starts in January?
I'd have to ask Mr. Bodern about that. But if someone resigns when we're out of session, then the governor can determine a special election process. And I don't know whether they can't take office until in an election, an otherwise general election year, where the general election is the same thing as a special election.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, I can give a couple examples. I mean, just last year, for instance, Representative De La Forest resigned after the session ended. He had a couple of months left for his term. But he resigned and left the legislature, but the legislature was no longer in session.
Right.
There wouldn't have been a need to call a special election because he wasn't running for re-election. The term was going to be expired a few months anyway, and somebody was actually elected in November, but the person didn't take office immediately because the person wasn't elected in a special election.
Oh.
This person was elected in November for the term that was going to start the following January.
No, but Senator Wellstone's term was
different. U.S. because Senator Wellstone had some time left in his term, which was filled by the governor. But I was raising the question because of what you were talking about in the legislature to find out if this was going to affect mm-hmm. legislative terms, because my view, and I would hope that we'd still do it, that if it's just there would not need to have be a reason for somebody to take office immediately if the office happens to be vacant and is going to expire anyway for the legislature. There's no reason to do that. The person would just wait until January and start it. The office may be vacant, but there's no reason to do it. And in particular, there's a reason why you would not want to do it that way, because, for instance, when redistricting comes around, you might have somebody assuming an office for an area that they're not even supposed to be representing. So
in trying to explain the complications of it all, that there's a difference between the federal offices and the special elections and the legislature ones. But I was also just trying to draw some parallels.
Okay. Well,
if you look at section two of the bill, you can see that it's different.
Okay. Well, that was confusing me, because I just wanted to make sure that this would not be saying that for a legislator, because those are the parallels
it's
you
different.
Were making, that if a legislator was just being elected to an office that was vacant, the term was expiring anyway, that legislator would not be assuming office immediately, but would have to wait until January to start the regular term.
What the current law did, and I guess I didn't explain it very well, what the current law did was lump members of Congress and members of the legislature all together. And what the bill does is to separate the members of Congress and the U.S. Senate into one category and leave the way in which legislators are elected in terms of special elections with current law.
Okay. Okay, so we're really, Mr. Chair and Senator Rust, we're not changing the law as it applies to members of the legislature.
No.
It's only as to members of Congress and the U.S. Senate.
But I thought it would be, and I guess it wasn't helpful, to have members think of what happens now with special elections for legislators as to why it would be a good reason to change the system and allow a special election when there is a vacancy for a U.S. senator. And it is when there is an unexpired term. It's just that special election, although it need not be on a general election day, it might be.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Chair, then,
Senator Betzel.
As I recall, when Representative Vento died with a few months left in his term, he was not going to seek re-election anyway, but he passed away before his term expired. And then we went through the primary process to determine the candidates, and ultimately in November, Representative McCollum was elected. Mm-hmm. I don't recall whether she took office immediately or I think she had to wait until January before she assumed office. So that congressional seat was vacant. A couple of months because
and that
of
would that.
That
would be changed here. And and here's here's a timeline. Let's say that one of our United States senators had gone into the Obama candidate thing.
Cabinet.
Okay. Rather than saying they died, let's say they had taken another job, that on January 1st of 2009, but their term was going to not end until January 5th of 2013. Mm-hmm. The governor then, within 5 days, would need to issue a writ of election, and the election would need to be held between 80 and 100 days after that writ, so no later than April 29th on some appropriate Tuesday. However, if the vacancy didn't occur until after July 1st of 2012, then there would be no special election. The general election would not only determine the U.S. Senate for the following term, but it also would allow the person who won that general election to fill the remainder of the term that had been vacated after July 1st of 2012.
they'd be seated right away in November.
Right. Good. Which is different than for the legislature.
Right. Okay.
So, Mr. Chairman, did we vote on the A1 amendment?
No, we did not. Senator Rust renews her motion that A1, incorporating the technical changes, be adopted. Any more discussion? All those in favor? Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Then, Mr. Chairman, there did the motion I'll make on the bill is to send it to finance because there was some question, even though these things happen, you know, once every 25 years, about even in the unlikely instance that we would counter this again soon, that these elections not be seen, particularly the vacancy election, the vacancy of nomination election, not be seen as creating a burden on counties to conduct that election, even though, as Ms. Fraser pointed out, it's required under HAVA because you just can't have a ballot that is not part of all the accessibility requirements. So there is the A2 amendment that I'll offer that would call upon the Secretary of State to reimburse counties and municipalities for expenses that they incurred administering a special election under the vacancy in nomination part of the bill. And it goes into the process by which that reimbursement would be made, and since it's a federal mandate on the states that it should be the state that is picking up the cost and not sending it down to the counties in this instance. So I would offer the A2 amendment. You take a look at it, and if you have any questions, again, Ms. Fraser is here to answer them.
Senator Rust moves the A2 amendment. Discussion on that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Roebling.
I'm just trying to put something together here in my head. This nomination one, how far ahead before a general election would someone have to pass away or become gravely ill so that this would kick in? I suppose it happened 3 weeks before the election. Did you consider that enough time?
Yes, because the ballot that would still be there on the general election day in that office just simply would not count. It would not count. And we have in that bill, we have some scheduling things that make sure that people are not confused by that in terms of when the announcement of the election would be and who the candidates would be. So that if the candidate died the day before the election, we would not be electing a dead person. That election would be null and void. The party would be able to name a candidate. The election, the absentee ballots would go out once again right away, and there would be an election between the candidates selected by the various parties, one that had not died, and then the party would choose the candidate to be in the election. There would be no primary, and the filing for the affidavits of candidacy would remain in place for the other parties who had filed for office. Yes?
Ms. Frazier?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, there are about 8 or 9 weeks between the primary and the general election, which is a pretty compressed schedule given everything that has to happen during that period of time, the ballots needing to be printed, the voting tabulators needing to be programmed, the accessible voting equipment needing to be programmed. And basically, once the list of candidates is certified, the train is in motion, and it's really impossible to stop it and change the names around. And so the way that this bill would work is if a candidate died after the primary, then this would kick in. So it's a fairly narrow window. I mean, it's only 8 weeks out of...
But it could happen the day before, too. Right. But any time after the primary, because you wouldn't be able to change the stuff.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, that's what would happen for partisan elections. For nonpartisan elections, that nothing would happen. And either the other candidate would be elected or the person who died would be elected, in which case there would be a vacancy in office because that person presumably would not step forward to take office. And then there are statutes that spell out what happens in those circumstances, either a special election or an appointment.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Senator Roebling, it's complicated, and it's complicated also putting these two together, but it does work. And it does abide by HAVA.
Senator Betzold.
And Senator Rust, does this in any way affect the succession to governor by a lieutenant governor? Because there could be an office in the vacancy of governor at any time.
No, these vacancies in office are specified in the, I don't think there is, well, maybe there is. What happens when it's governor in your bill?
Mr. Chair, Senator Betzold, this is just about vacancy and nomination. Oh, yes. So this is
not
just about
office.
The candidates on the ballot.
Okay. So if at some point there was a vacancy in the office of governor and lieutenant governor succeeded, and there was an upcoming election, I mean, what would happen there? Because the lieutenant governor being the governor would be maybe different from the candidate who was nominated. So we'd start all over again. Is that what would happen then?
Mr. Chair, Senator Betzold, if between the primary and the general election a candidate for governor died, this would kick in, and the political party with whom that candidate was associated would have the opportunity to nominate a different candidate for governor. The other candidates from the ballot would just carry forward and be the candidates for the special election.
Okay. But
So there could be the case that the lieutenant governor could become governor,
right,
and the and nothing would be decided in the general election, but then the party could choose that lieutenant governor who is now governor to be their candidate in the special election moving forward, and they could put somebody else in as lieutenant governor. Or alternatively, they could say that their candidate for governor is not the lieutenant governor who assumed the governorship, but someone else.
And then, Carrot, Mr. Chair, and Senator Rust, to carry it one step further, I mean, we've been going under the assumption that there may be some time left in the term. And a winner could serve out the unexpired term that was left. Now, in the case of a governor, lieutenant governor, there's always going to be somebody there to fill out a term.
Right. So that wouldn't apply. Yeah. This bill does not apply to constitutional officers.
I see. Okay. Okay. Thank you.
So back to the A2 amendment.
So, Mr. Chairman, I would move the A2 amendment.
Senator Rust moves the A2 amendment. Any further discussion? All those in favor, aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 278 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Finance.
Senator Rust moves Senate File 278. All those in favor, aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
And
thank you, Senator Rust.
Mr. Chairman, that being said, I would still like to move the other bill to the floor as a vehicle, if need be, later on.
Senator Sieben moves Senate files, the subcommittee report on Senate File 745, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
All those in favor? Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
And then, Mr.
Senator
Chairman,
Rust
I would
moves
move
Senate File 45.
745.
As amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the floor.
Right.
All those in favor? Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
And I realize that it's without those amendments, but we could. Brings us Senate File 658. Senator Stephen moves the subcommittee report. Is there a subcommittee report on this one?
Yes. Madam Chair, there is a subcommittee report. The A3 amendment reflects the changes of that report. So I don't know if we need to move.
Well, we will set the subcommittee report aside and just take up the. Take up the
A3 amendment.
Let me just get to it. Take up 658. And then it is a delete everything amendment. Is that correct?
That's correct. And as I said, this reflects what the work that the subcommittee did.
Okay. Well, then Senator Sieben, for the discussion here, then moves adoption of the A3 amendment. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. So the substance of the bill is the A3 amendment. Senator Sieben.
It's easier. Madam Chair, I do have... don't let me forget, I do have the A4 amendment, too, which is a technical amendment to the...
Senator Sieben moves the A4 amendment.
Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Before that one is passed, I was just looking at the A4, and it strikes that you must be a resident of the state, but the A3 just said you must be a registered voter.
Right.
204C.
And so would we be eliminating the need to be a registered voter?
No.
Madam
because
Chair.
It's in Section 201-504 defined.
Okay, so we would still be required to be a registered voter.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, the A4 amendment is intended to more carefully reflect the qualifications required for a challenger before the challenge can be made. And you'll see that it has the cross-reference to 204C.07, which is the section that's Section 1 of the A3 amendment. So the two are linked together.
And Senator Roebling, in the subcommittee, we did talk about what the current law requires, is that that you only be a resident, and why would we change it to be a registered voter? And then we had discussions, well, if it's just a resident, you could be a felon and be a challenger, or you could be 14 and be a challenger. And so we agreed in the subcommittee that a registered voter was more protection all around for everybody. Senator Sieben?
Madam Chair, I think we need to vote on the A4 amendment.
Unless there's some objection.
Unless there's more questions about that.
Senator Sieben moves the A4 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for those members who were not on the subcommittee, the bill in its current form, in Section 1, it requires that polling place challengers must be registered voters, as Madam Chair just described. And current law just requires that challengers are residents. And then later on in Section 1, it requires challengers to sign a written statement that says that they are a registered voter and that if they want to be a challenger, they understand the standards of conduct to be a challenger. Section 2, there are additional prohibitions on conduct of challengers. First, they would be prohibited from using electronic communication devices inside the polling places, and that the second prohibition would new prohibition would be that they're prohibited from interfering with an election judge who is performing official duties. And then Section 3 of the amendment of the A3 amendment would repeal the requirement or the option to have a challenger for elections on a question. So with that, I'll stand for questions.
Okay, are there questions for Senator Sieben on the challenger bill? Does anyone in the audience want to speak either in favor or in opposition to the bill as now amended before us?
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
On the last line, 210, it says, interfere with an election judge who is performing official duties. So, if you have a challenge, would you not be able to interfere somehow or bring that challenge to the judge? I don't know if he would be calling it interfering, though, but I'm concerned that somebody might.
The experience that was told to us in the subcommittee was of a head election judge in Anoka County who was confronted by a challenger and told that she was breaking the law and she didn't know what her job was and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And not only was she not breaking the law and doing her job, since there were challengers in other parts of the county, she also became concerned that maybe those challengers were interfering with people carrying out their election judge duties. But the challenger challenges the legitimacy of a voter's registration attempt. That's the only thing they can challenge. And that is done directly to the election judge. Senator Sieben, do I have that one right?
That's correct.
And so an election judge could say to a person, you're interfering with my ability or my actions to perform my duties. I'm calling the cops to remove you, to ask you to leave, if they didn't leave. Okay, anything else on that one? Senator Carlson, you have a question?
Madam Chair and Senator Sieben, it seems to me I remember that, and I would assume that it happens on more than one party, but that the challengers occasionally call their legal representation to inquire on particular procedures. And it seems to me that, in fact, I was out door knocking with one of those legal people, and they were calling the Secretary of State's office for opinions. Is that something that they would have to do outside of the polls then? Is that, and if there's something that needs to be relayed to the judge, is that something that they could do with their communication device? And I think it's good to not use a communication device, and good not to use it at the polls, but is there some situations that perhaps this might interfere with?
Madam Chair and Senator Carlson, what the language is proposing is that they would not be able to use an electronic communication device, whether that would be a cell phone or a computer or a BlackBerry, within the polling place. So I think your question is, if someone contacted the Secretary of State's office or wanted to look up a particular statute, could they use that device to show the election judge? And the answer would be no. They would not be able to do that.
Okay. Madam Chair, does
Senator
that,
Carlson?
Do you think that handicaps it all?
Madam Chair.
Senator Sieben?
And Senator Carlson, I'm comfortable with that language because we heard testimony in the subcommittee in some cases where especially laptops were being used in a way that seemed to be inappropriate. Is there anything you'd like to add, Ms. Frazier?
Madam Chair, Senator Carlson, election judges are instructed that if they have questions, they should be communicating with the municipal clerk or the county auditor, and that, you know, we often get calls from those those people on election day. And so I think it's more appropriate for the election judge who has questions to be making calls rather than the challenger. You know, if the challenger has a question, they should ask a question of the election judge, but it should be the election judge that's seeking other resources and relying upon those resources. The election judge shouldn't be looking to the challenger to tell them what the law is or have the challenger telling them what to do or bossing them around.
Okay. Sounds good.
Further questions or comments for Senator Sieben? Seeing none, Senator Sieben moves that Senate file 658 as amended be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Now, Senator Sieben has Senate file 801.
Madam Chair, Senate file 801 is a housekeeping bill that the Secretary of State's office asked me to bring forward, and we should adopt the subcommittee report.
Senator Sieben moves with the subcommittee report on Senate File 801 be adopted. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. We have the We now have Senate File 801 before us. Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I will ask Ms. Fraser to explain the bill, if that's okay.
Ms. Fraser?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This housekeeping bill, basically, it looks like a long bill, but it really doesn't do much, which may be surprising. What it does is the statutes refer to different colored ballots. Back in the old days, there were white ballots for state offices and yellow ballots for other offices and blue ballots for other offices and pink ballots and gray ballots, and the statute still refers to all of these different type of ballots. It also implies, because of the way it's written, that hand counting is the standard, whereas at this point, counting ballots by machine is the norm and hand counting is really the exception. So what this bill does is it removes all of the language related to colored ballots. It changes the language related to counting of ballots to make clear that machine counting is the norm, but that there are still some places that have central count machines where all the ballots are brought to one location, and some locations where they are counted by hand. It consolidates language related to formatting ballots all into one chapter of law instead of having it spread out in several chapters. It consolidates language related to election judge duties into a different chapter of law instead of spread out into many different chapters. The big change that it makes is that it changes the typeface on the ballots. Right now, ballots have to be in all caps, which is hard to read, and lots of studies have shown that. So it changes the type on the ballots to upper and lower case, with the exception of warnings related to you may be voting for a tax increase. That's one of the changes the subcommittee made, was they wanted that to stay in all caps. It standardizes the language for filling a vacancy. Right now, there are about three different variations of what the language might be if there's a special election on the ballot. And it modifies other ballot instructions to make them easier to understand. So although there's a lot of stricken language and a lot of new language, for the most part, it's moving language from one section of statute to another to make the order of the statutes more logical and easier to find pieces of information.
Okay, are there any questions on Senate File 801? Senator Lori.
On page 7 of the bill, I was just engrossing from the subcommittee report, and on page 7, lines 728 and 729, we struck metal strap with A, and then on 29 we struck metal, but then it still talks of a strap. So the first says, each seal shall consist of a numbered self-locking device, and then the next sentence is no two straps. So either it's a device or a strap, and we should make them work together, I would think. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if it's a device or a strap, but for consistency's purposes, we should say which it is.
Where are you looking?
On page 7, lines 28 through 30, if you engross the amendments adopted at in the subcommittee report.
Oh, we need the subcommittee report.
The subcommittee report said on line 728, strike metal strap with A. and on line 29, strike metal, so that what we wind up with is a numbered device, and then no two straps shall bear the same number. So I, you know, just for consistency, we should. And I don't know what they are.
Madam Chair, I think that Ms. Fraser just suggested that on line 7.28, we reinsert the language strap with A. So we are only striking the word
metal.
Metal.
That would make them consistent.
Senator Sieben moves to amend,
the committee report.
Senate file, whatever it is.
Amend the committee report.
Madam Chair, it might be easiest to amend the committee report.
Committee report. And moves to amend the committee report on line 26 of the committee report, page 7, line 28, delete.
Delete strap with A.
Mr. Bonin, how do we say that? Reinsert metal?
I think on page 1, line 26 of the committee report, you can simply delete metal so that you have metal would be stricken in both places.
So it would be...
I'm sorry.
Be strike metal and then delete,
delete
the rest
strap
of the
with
language,
A.
Yeah. Right?
Strap with
so
A. Delete strap with A.
Leave strike metal and simply delete on line 26 of the amendment, delete strap with A.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay, and that would get it back to a numbered strap with A. Okay, Senator Sieben moves that. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Laura, for seeing that.
Mm-hmm.
Sharp eye. Is there further discussion of this bill? Senator Olsen.
I know we had discussions about, is this the bill that has in it where you have to vote by Xing out or with an X? Where is that being cleaned up? There was language, I thought it might have been in the big bill, and I thought this might be the bill.
Madam Chair, it is in this bill.
Oh, okay, I thought
it. Around page 13, Ms. Fraser is telling me. If you look in section 20.
And there's all kinds of repealers here, too, members, that you should be, that you should look at. Senator Sieben, what page was it on?
13. Page 13, sections 18, 19, 20. 21.
So there, we talk there about ovals rather than X's, okay, because we don't use those anymore, or completes an arrow, either one of those two. Any other questions about Senate File 801? Is there anyone who wishes to speak about this bill?
This is for the guidance.
Seeing none, Senator Sieben moves that Senate File 801, as amended, be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Then we have Senate File 853, and Senator Sieben moves the subcommittee report on Senate File 853. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails, and the subcommittee report is adopted, and we have Senate File 853 as amended before us. Senator Sieben.
Madam Chair and members, this Senate File 853 allows voters to vote by absentee ballot for without excuse. So it really brings into line what is current practice right now, where voters are going and requesting absentee ballots either because they think they might be out of town or they're not sure if they're going to be out of town. And this would, one interesting thing that came out in subcommittee was that if you falsely apply for an absentee ballot, you are, if someone would choose to prosecute you, you are committing a felony.
That's weird.
So really, as we see more and more people voting by absentee ballot, I think that it's important that we try to make sure that that isn't the case so that people can vote by absentee if they should want to. We heard from some electrical workers who were concerned that they may be out of town or may be called out of town at the last minute, but they didn't know if they were going to be. So they would like to be able to not have an excuse to vote or not need to give an excuse to vote by absentee because they're not sure. They could be out of town, but chances are they will be in town. So this simply allows for voters to vote without excuse.
And it's keeping the issues of early voting separate from absentee voting,
correct,
which you have in another bill.
Oh, that was my question, Madam Chair, to refresh my memory.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Questions, comments for Senator Sieben on Senate File 853? Anyone want to speak about it? Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, I'm glad she's carrying this. I think it's long overdue.
Further comments?
Madam Chair?
Senator Betzel?
One comment. This is an odd way for Senator Sieben to spend her birthday.
Yes. This is Senator Sieben's 32nd birthday. Happy birthday, Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I get to go to Environment Committee shortly.
You bring it
we're done early, but yeah, you don't get out early. Senator Sieben moves that Senate File 853, as amended, be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. We will be meeting on Wednesday, and again, we'll be meeting on Friday, and the agenda is piling up as people are coming, including members of the committee, and saying, I really need to get this bill heard to meet the deadline. So I hope that everyone will be here and be on time to establish a quorum so that we can move through a number of bills. Some of them are controversial. Some of them are ones that only deal with rulemaking or that set up Senator Roebling has a bill that sets up a little advisory group on firefighters, but unfortunately it also needs to go to the Judiciary Committee. So we need to act
every
on that
bill
one on Wednesday. And any number of things like that are coming up. So I beg the committee's indulgence of other members, but we will try and get as much accomplished as we
can
on Wednesday and Friday.
When I see so many bills going to the Judiciary Committee, I start feeling that I'm derelict in my duty. So I've started getting more bills coming to higher ed.
Oh, there please you go. No.
If you mention higher ed, it comes to my committee. You mention the U of M or Minsky, it's coming to my committee.
There being no further business,
Senator Betzel. I see them both,
Senator
but
Betzel.
I do commend Ms. Schaefer because just in the time we've been here, she's changed the agenda on Wednesdays already. So, I mean, just a couple minutes ago. So
she's good.
We're sitting here.
We're sitting here. So thank you very much, members. You're great, and we stand adjourned.